Get a free bottle of Johnnie Walker Black Label Whiskey when you subscribe to The Spectator in our Black Friday sale. Go to spectator.co.uk/Friday.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American power, politics and prejudices. The election is over, but the Americano never stops, and there will be a lot to talk about with the second Trump administration. And so we'll bring you more and more Americano, because judging from the feedback, that's what you guys want. So please keep listening. I'm delighted to be joined today by Tara Palmieri, who is a writer for Puck, and I think essential reading during this presidential transition, this period where we are waiting for the incoming Trump administration to get into office. And there's always backstabbings and fights going on in any presidential transition. But this one, I think, even compared to the last Trump transition, has been particularly interesting. Would you say it's been particularly fractious, Tara?
Yeah, I mean, it is very fractious. That's just like one of the features of a Trump organization, Trump administration, Trump campaign. He likes to bring in a team of rivals. The thing is that it seems even heightened compared to the 2016 transition, because the characters are even more type A, even more up a notch. They are overtly campaigning for their chosen personnel appointments, cabinet appointments, in a way that we didn't see before. I mean, you would read stories with background quotes making arguments as to why Gary Cohn's a globalist and doesn't deserve to be in the National Economic Council, or, you know, Dina Powell should also not be involved in the National Economic Council. And that was generally coming from the right wing, Breitbart lane. Or you'd hear, oh, that the White House is overstaffed with RNC staffers because Ryan Priebus is the chief of staff and he brought over all of his Republican National Committee minions, which is typical. Like every, you know, administration, the top staffers bring over their minions, you know, and they fill out the administration with their loyalists. And that was a way of survival in the Trump administration. It's not generally as necessary in other administrations, but it's political. You know, we know how it works. It works the same way, I'm sure, across the pond. It's just gotten like so much more overt, extreme, in your face. Like Elon Musk is tweeting about who his preferred pick would be for Treasury Secretary, calling the person that Trump ultimately chose, Scott Bessent, you know, business as usual, and campaigning for Howard Lutnick. You know, Howard Lutnick is the transition chairman who should be, you know, weeding through resumes and making recommendations for appointments. And yet he spent the entire time lobbying for himself for transition chairman, he lobbied the entire time for Treasury Secretary, and he got Commerce Secretary as sort of like a consolation prize, which was what the other transition chair, Linda McMahon, wanted. And then you've got this character, Boris Epstein, who's been with Trump for the past 8 years, literally going to people like Scott Bessent and saying, I'll help you get a position in the cabinet. I'll put in a good word for you around Mar-a-Lago for $100,000, literally asking for money to make recommendations to Trump. And, you know, he was a part of the plan to get Matt Gaetz the attorney general position. And it's just gotten really intense. And like Donald Trump Jr., I think he's filled the vacuum that Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump had in the White House. But he's just like in your face, has his podcast, his like grassroots, he's a meme warrior. And they're all sort of fighting these wars for who should fill out the cabinet in the public rather than in like a private sphere. But by the way, privately, it's gotten so intense that like the Washington Post reported that Howard Lutnick and Boris Epstein literally got in a shoving match at Mar-a-Lago, and that there's like screaming on the patio. So as much aggression as you're seeing in public, you're seeing in private, it's even more intense. So it's kind of fascinating to see it all play out like this. And Trump enjoys watching people fight for his attention. And he ultimately didn't take Elon Musk's recommendation for Treasury Secretary, even though Elon Musk gave him $120 million to work on a ground game. But I think that was Trump's way of saying, like having you around, appreciate your your contribution, your opinions, but I'm the president. And I think, you know, one day if Saturday Night Live depicts Elon Musk as like the president, and Trump as like his pupil or something like that, then you're going to see a change in their relationship, because that's what they did with Bannon, and it really soured his relationship with Steve Bannon.
Let's talk a bit more about Boris Epstein, because we should say he's denied these allegations, hasn't he? But the report is that Trump's team, legal team, did an investigation into people's consulting commitments, and they discovered this evidence. And they concluded that his relationship with Trump should be terminated. But what I'm picking up is among the sort of MAGA loyalists, they're very angry about this story breaking, and that they're blaming Susie Wiles, because it seemed to come initially through John Solomon, who writes a Just the News website. And so now they see Susie Wiles, who in your most recent report, forgive me if you've done another, but the most recent I've read, you described as kind of emerging strangely victorious from this. But now, so the loyalists are gunning for Susie Wiles now.
Oh, yeah. And I'm not surprised. Like, it's almost an impossible job that she has as chief of staff. Your role as chief of staff in an administration is essentially to be a gatekeeper of the information flow that comes into the president so that he can make the best decision that he can make, right? Trump doesn't want a gatekeeper. Trump likes the colorful characters all around him, and Trump enjoys the chaos. So Susie Wiles was not in the part of the cabin of the plane where they decided that they were going to nominate Attorney General, Matt Gaetz, Attorney General. And this is a decision that she had to deal with for weeks after. You know, they had to do an entire campaign, go on Capitol Hill, take the temperature of senators. It sucked up tons of news cycles, right? Trying to figure out what would happen if Matt Gaetz was put before the Senate for confirmation hearings. And you know, she could have probably avoided a lot of wasted time if she was there and able to stop those shenanigans from happening. But she doesn't have that kind of control. And I think, you know, Reince Priebus, who was chief of staff, learned that probably a little too late. John Kelly quit the second chief of staff because he couldn't handle it. Or maybe he was the second chief of staff. And you just sort of have to accept you're kind of playing the role of babysitter for Trump, but you're not keeping the doors closed. You're not even able to really weed out the information flow. I remember when I first started reporting on Trump in 2016, I learned that during the campaign that they were feeding him positive news stories to keep him in a good mood. Like, because he doesn't use the computer. He calls his iPad the flat one. Like, he's not very technologically savvy. This is a guy who doesn't really read books. I mean, he reads the New York Times. He reads the Wall Street Journal. He loves the New York Post. I know that. I used to work at the New York Post and had to speak with him frequently. But this is a guy who lives in like 1980s, okay, and has not actually emerged. He's ossified in that period of time. Those were his golden years. And so they can sort of control his information flow with that, but he has a lot of friends around him too that will pass him news stories. He likes the kitchen cabinet. I mean, he lives in a members only club right now where people who can afford now what is over a million dollars a year or initiation fee, not per year, but initiation fee, can essentially walk up to him on the patio and give him some advice or lobby for their cause. So it's really difficult to contain the flow of information and for him to get an idea and just fire off, tweet, make a decision. I think Susie's been able to survive, though. She survived at the head of the Trump, you know, organization, you could say, since after January 2021. I think she came in March, after January 6th, when he was really at his low point. And she was mostly able to survive by allowing him to, in the words of Corey Lewandowski, let Trump be Trump. But actually, when Corey Lewandowski came in and tried to take her job, that was like a tipping point for her, where she finally went up to Trump and said, hey, it's me or him. So, you know, she has her breaking points too. I don't think, you know, it's a hard thing to do. I mean, she's a woman she's in her late 60s or early 70s. I mean, she's been around for a while in this game. She was not a national player before. She was always Florida-based. I think she's shown her influence already by getting in a lot of Florida lawmakers and allies like Marco Rubio to be Secretary of State. He was a former client of hers. Pam Bondi ends up getting the job of Attorney General, another ally of hers, Mike Waltz, Florida congressman. If you look at this cabinet, it is very highly represented by Florida representatives, officials, politicians, personnel. She's brought in a lot of her loyalists from Ron DeSantis's team. He fired her a while back. So, you know, she's certainly showing that she has influence, but she has to watch out because the knives are going to come for her too.
She does seem to be a very wily operator, if you'll forgive the pun. But she is also a woman, and I think it's quite interesting with Trump and sort of senior staff who are female. Yeah. I don't know if he ever kind of throws them under the bus in quite the same way. Can you think of any, as he has done with a lot of his male staff?
Omarosa? I don't know.
Omarosa, I suppose. Yeah, that's, yeah. I mean, there's bound to be a few.
He did secretly record them all in the White House. So,
yeah. Okay, maybe that's a bad thought.
That's a good question. I mean, has there been a senior female staffer that he's really thrown under the bus? I mean, Kellyanne Conway has stayed around this entire time. He's had his hot and cold periods with her, specifically like when people write books and it's not always a flattering portrait. He tends to, like, she wrote in her book that he lost the election and that really pissed him off. But she managed to stay around and she's still pretty close with him. It's a good question about whether women get tossed aside. I mean, he hates Elaine Chao. She left the administration after January 6th. He doesn't hold, it's not like he's like, oh, for women, I will hold my tongue. You know what I mean? I'll bite my tongue and be polite because they're women and I need to be genteel. No, he's like, he just called Maggie Haberman, Maggot Haberman. Like he's not, he certainly has no, he doesn't have like a certain respect for the other sex. I just think women probably, and this is a generalization, but like, sometimes they're better at playing the long game, the politics, and they're not, their egos are less wrapped up in every single machination in the same way. Like the men that are around Donald Trump are bombastic, a lot of them, very gregarious. They are type A. They see a lot of themselves in Trump. Interestingly, a lot of them are sober too. And Trump is sober, which I think is kind of interesting that they, there's a lot of them that they just don't drink. And I don't know if it's because they do it because he doesn't drink. But it's kind of one of the weird features of his administration that I noticed. Like usually when you go out with a source, and I'm sure you know this in the UK, you go out for a drink. Not many of them actually have any drinks.
It's very bad news for journalism. I suppose on the plus side, they act like they're drunk when they talk anyway.
Yeah, true. But I don't know if exactly. I mean, it's interesting because people are like, well, Trump, his team kicked you out of their, their victory party. Like you must be in the doghouse, and it's like actually it doesn't really matter because there's so many other channels to which people will speak to me, and I've never had a hard time with being on the outs. In fact, usually when you're on the outs, that's where the disgruntled people who are willing to like actually tell you what's going on are willing. You know this as a journalist, but.
Well, this is why I mean, I love writing about America because even though I'm not tremendously uninformed about anything, I find with Trump world, it's so on its face. You know, you can sort of see what's going on. Obviously, you have greater insights because of your experience, but you can see what's going on even if you're at a distance.
Oh, for sure, because he tweets out a lot of what he's thinking. I mean, it's like a lie. He'll be like, I didn't say that. I barely know her, which means he probably talks to her every single day. Like he tweeted about me and said something like, fake news, I don't even know her. Like, okay, fine. You know what I mean? It's just like, he said, I think I tweeted that he, not tweeted. I wrote a piece a while ago about how he wanted to sue David Muir over the debates. And he ended up suing CBS over, I can't remember what it was that he ended up wanting to sue. But like he was thinking about all the news outlets that he would sue, and he wanted to sue David Muir. And I wrote about this, and I knew that he had told people this. And he's like, Tara Palmieri, fake news. I don't even know her, but I should sue him. What do you think? Like something along those lines. And it's like he's using the attacks to channel what he really wants to do. You could almost take everything that Trump says as like really coded for like a denial is usually an admission. And it's just, it's kind of like you start to understand his language after a while.
And do you think, I mean, with Boris Epstein, the sort of the the on D from Trump people seems to be he will be put on the bench for a while, but he's too close to the family to be sort of frozen out permanently. How close to the family is he?
Yeah, he is. I mean, close to the family. I don't know if that's where I would put him. I think he's, I think Melania likes him, but, you know, Melania, say, hasn't gone very far. She wanted Doug Burgum to be his running mate. He didn't pick him. He wanted Rick Grenell to be the Secretary of State. He didn't pick Rick Grenell. So I would think, yeah, I think Melania likes Boris. Boris was there for Trump after January 6th. A lot of the people that were with Trump after January 6th have a certain carte blanche, like, around there. And they, he remembers that because that was his exile, his darkest hours. And Boris was there, and he's been working on his legal fights. And that's been, like, something that has really dogged him for a long time when a lot of other lawyers didn't want to go anywhere near it. So I think ultimately, like, yes, Boris has been benched. I'm sure Boris will come back. If there's one feature of the Trump administration that I've learned is you can somehow always get back in. Someone who's been there to, like, I guess, foster reconciliation, you could say, has been Donald Trump Jr. He has a way of vouching for people, setting up sort of, I guess you could say, opportunities to mend the fences. So, for example, J.D. Vance called his father America's Hitler, said many terrible things about him, but somehow J.D. Vance needed Trump's endorsement in the Ohio Senate primary just a few years ago. It's crazy to think about that, 2022. And it was Donald Trump Jr. who vouched for J.D. and got, you know, a meeting with J.D. and Trump ultimately blessed him because J.D. was behind. He was in third in the race for Senate. Think of that. He would have never been the senator of Ohio if not for Trump. And that was because of Donald Trump Jr. Tucker Carlson said he deeply loathes Trump in those Dominion text messages that came out during the lawsuit and, you know, during discovery, how much he hated Trump. There was a problem there in their relationship. Donald Trump Jr. set it up. Cliff Sims, who's running personnel in the transition, not as well known, but it was the deputy director of national intelligence. And before that, he was a comms staffer, like, I don't know, maybe not even deputy communications director, like something a little bit lower than that. But he wrote a book when he left called The Team of Vipers about the kind of nastiness, the factious relationships between the staffers, all of it, the silos, the infighting. And Trump didn't read the book, but he assumed that it was a bad portrayal of him in his White House, sued Cliff Sims. Sims sued back. So you would think these people would never speak again, right? Sims ends up back in the White House or in the administration as deputy DNI, a higher role than ever before, 2 years later. And now he's running point on the transition and personnel. And this is because of a reconciliation set up by Donald Trump Jr. So Donald Trump Jr. has a lot of weight. And I do think that he is often able to get Trump, to get people back. And if there's one thing Donald Trump Jr. obviously understands about his father is that he loves a convert, like more than he does someone who already loves him. Now, the problem with Boris is he's not really a convert. And Trump, if there's one thing Trump hates, is people making money off of him. But the truth is they all have clients on the side who Trump endorsed, a lot of them. And that has made them money. I mean, if you're Susie Wiles, I don't know if Susie has clients this time around, but I think she had clients in 2022, like Blake Masters. And if Trump is going to endorse you, Blake lost. But, you know, that's a huge, that's worth a lot of money. And that makes you much more desirable as a candidate, I mean, as a consultant. So I just don't think it can be as overt as pay me and I will get you a meeting. I will get you a meeting with Trump where you can make your pitch to be Treasury Secretary, which is what he did. He asked Scott Bessent for $100,000. Like, that's crazy.
I suppose that does suggest, though, that Trump is often called thin-skinned and vindictive and so on. And I'm sure there is truth in that. But he is also, he doesn't care. That's the other thing. That's the more fundamental thing. And or perhaps even there's a forgiving streak in him.
I think he cares in the time at the moment, but I think he likes to see people grovel.
Yeah, yeah. that's I'm sure that's true. But it goes. Susie Wells has a consultancy firm, which is, there's already been reporting on this.
Well, she's a partner at Mercury, which is now one of the most influential. It was very influential before, but she's a partner at Mercury. I think Mercury probably has an office in the UK too. They're global at this point.
And so people are going to say she's, you know, Mercury has China on the list and you know, Qatar and things like that. And that will be thrown at her.
Pam Bondi was a foreign agent for Qatar at one point.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Would you ever be able to do that and then be in the British government?
Almost certainly. You'd probably be foreign secretary. Yeah. 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 Actually, not Qatar. It has to be the UAE. I mean, yeah, our politics is a whole different type of corrupt. But so we seem to be moving now away from the personnel phase and towards the sort of policy phase, because the personnel is not complete, but it's the big jobs are mostly picked. And now we are getting into the policy announcements. And I find it interesting that Trump uses sort of policy yin to personnel yang sometimes. So after Scott Bessent was announced, you know, because he was thought to be this calming figure for the markets and so on, we then immediately get the tariff announcement, you know, quite hardline tariff announcement, which obviously that may be jockeying for position and so on. But do you think there is an element of that, you know, he sees who's disappointed by an appointment and tries to please them with a policy?
I don't know. I don't think Trump's that like strategic or gives a shit about anyone except himself. And right. I don't know.
Okay. And what
I think about him on a very base level, to be honest.
Yeah.
Whenever I think there's strategy, I'm usually wrong.
Yeah, that's probably the best way of doing it.
I think he otherwise thinks you about drive things yourself on mad. A gut level, which makes him good at politics. I mean, I know like some people are playing three-dimensional chess. I think he's not even on the board. I think he's dancing on it, just like destroying it with his brute force.
And so what you've written a tiny bit about the Democrats. Can we talk about them for a second?
Oh yeah, they're a disaster too.
It's a complete disaster. There's a lot of blame going around. There's a feeling that everybody hated Kamala Harris all along, and that can now
be... they always did. Yeah, that's not a feeling. Like, that's an actual accurate description of... They always thought she was like a weak candidate. She came in fourth in the Democratic primary in 2020. I mean, 2019 technically, but yes, no, she was always a weak candidate. And there was, even before that, like there was no love between Kamala Harris's office, the vice president's office, and Joe Biden's office, especially because Jill Biden, who's like the protector of Joe, did not like, you know, the busing comment during the debate when she was said, you know, basically accused him of being a racist segregationist, saying I was that little girl that you allowed busing to be affected by. And so there was never a lot of love. You know, she was seen with a bit of suspicion, right? They always felt that because of how she botched that Lester Holt interview when asked about why she hadn't gone to the border, you know, she said, well, I haven't even been to Europe yet. And even just getting the border czar position really angered her office, because that's obviously a loser. They felt like he should have been preparing her for some sort of success. Whereas, you know, Biden being in the White House with Barack Obama felt like, hey, I was given all the shitty jobs as well, and this is just part of being vice president. And hey, I didn't get a lot of love working for Barack Obama, and you're not going to get it. This is a part of being vice president, right? But a lot of people in Harris's office felt like, you know, she's the future of the party because, frankly, you're too old to run again. A lot of them thought that. And outside of Washington, no one really, I mean, outside of the White House and even inside the White House, there was no real feeling that she was some great political athlete. In fact, I think she really impressed and surprised a lot of people with her outing and how she first came out of the gate, with her oratory skills, with her magnetism, and the way she was able to really kind of have a flawless rollout is the word they love to use, flawless. clearly people aren't buying flawless when it comes to politics, and I don't blame them. Because
it helps to be flawless when everyone in the media is saying how flawless you are, doesn't it?
Yeah, right, but who cares about flawless? But over and over again, you heard from voters that they wanted to know more about her. They didn't know her well enough, and yet her campaign kept her away from, you know, the press, traditional and non-traditional media for 30 whole days in a compressed, as you might call it, a snap election. And they wondered why everyone was sort of suspicious and wondering who this person was. I mean, as Americans, we are very distrustful of our politicians. Congress has like some of the lowest approval rating in the world. I mean, in our country, probably across the world, though everybody's a little, you know, questioning of politicians in general. And so to have like, I don't know, what does Trump teach us? A flawless politician means nothing. He ran campaigns, shambolic campaigns, speaking out of both sides of his mouth, not making any sense, often gibberish about boats with electric boats and sharks. And I could keep going about the madness that came out of his mouth. People didn't care. They're like, well, he's a real guy. He's not reading from a teleprompter. And the fact that he called her out for reading from teleprompters, like that was seen as pretty damaging when you look back on it. I mean, if there's one thing I think we've all learned is that Americans really want authenticity, not just from their politicians, but from their media. They are very distrustful. And she was a great performer and political athlete. I mean, I thought she did a great job at the debate, but I felt too at the same time at the debate when I watched her that she gave a lot of great talking points that could be clipped for viral, you know, moments on TikTok, YouTube, Twitter, et cetera. But in the interactions, the one-on-one interactions, they were very much like almost staged in a way. And I mean, she was asked very simple questions, like, what are you proud of by Anderson Cooper? If you're from your prosecutorial, you know, from your time as a AG in California, she really stumbled on stuff like that. Her answers to why she had such extreme positions in 2019, she would say, my values haven't changed. And it just rang hollow. You know, she could just say, I was wrong. You know what? I was wrong. And I it's like there's something to be said about the idea that, like, why can't a politician ever admit that they were wrong?
Yes. Well, but she was also, I mean, perhaps this is to her credit, she was arguably more loyal to Biden than she needed to be, having been, you know, having usurped him.
I understand that, but why be loyal to Joe Biden at some point? It's like, it's all about winning, right? You've just told the American people for the past few years that Donald Trump is a threat to democracy. Win at any cost then, right? Like that would be the mandate, I would think, as a candidate. And Joe Biden did not have a lot of love from the American people. You didn't need to stand by him. He basically hijacked a campaign for over a year. They changed the calendar to make sure that he would be the candidate. Once he was out there and had one-on-one time, most people who supported Joe Biden were holding their breath whenever he had to speak publicly, just hoping that he would be okay. Then he revealed what most Americans knew, was that he, as an 81-year-old man, was not prepared to run for re-election. And so if anything, like, Joe Biden did not really deserve that, in my opinion. Like, he'd, sure, in the be loyal to your boss, but really, who are you working for? You don't work for Joe Biden. You're trying to win a job that is given to you by the American people, not a job that's given to you by Joe Biden. And so it's awkward. The press might have been a little weird. But frankly, if she was seen as trashing Joe Biden when 2/3 of Americans said they didn't like the direction that America was going in, she may have had a fairer shake. Because my mother, I mean, I had her on my podcast, and I always use her as like my focus group, because she's lives in North Carolina, swing state. She is kind of a weird case because she came to America as an immigrant, became an American in 2001, voted for Bush as an immigrant. Like, she became an American, like, changed over from having a green card to American to vote for Bush. Then she votes for Obama, you know, then she votes for Hillary, then she votes for Trump. And then she was like, I don't know what to do. Like, abortion was very important to her, but kitchen table issues, like inflation, those were really other issues that mattered. And she remembered better economic times under Trump. And her main question was like, I just don't know her. Like, what is it going to be like? Is it just going to be more of Biden? And that's all she gathered. And so if you haven't convinced someone like my mother that you are going to be a split from the past, a break from the past, you're not going to win.
Mm. Well, people who are very interested in the culture wars like to say that the Democrats have kind of learned a lesson now that identity politics doesn't work.
Yeah, especially when you have so many Hispanics and African Americans and women voting for Trump.
Yeah. Well, do you think that they have actually learned that? Or do you think it's just part of the bloodstream now and we shouldn't get too excited about the fact that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has dropped her pronouns from her Twitter bio?
Yeah, I don't know. I always thought that was a bit much. Like, somebody called me the other day and asked me like what my pronouns were. And I was like, this is actually asking someone what their pronouns now has become almost offensive in American culture. Like, it's divisive. Like, the fact that you ask me what my pronouns are suggests to me that your political party. So you've just turned this conversation into a political one in a way, right? Like, it's like me calling you up and being like, and how many guns do you own?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. No, it is a lot like that.
It's like, okay, I'm like, I'm not a known transgender person. I have a pretty public profile. You don't have to ask me what my pronouns are. It's fine. Like, just call me Tara. She, it, I don't care. they, but I understand, and this isn't to take away from transgender people, but like, if you have a preference, make it known. But for everybody else, like, I think there was a situation in which we became so politically correct, the resistance to Trump swung so far to the left that it became absurd, in the same way that anything that swings either way too far becomes absurd. Like, if the Republicans go so far to the right and they start like taking away basic rights, which they already have through, you know, the overturning of Roe versus Wade from women and others, like, you're going to see a reaction in 2022 as well. I'm sorry, 2026. What am I saying? Wow. This has been a weird year. But yeah, you're going to see the pendulum swing back and forth. Like, if there's one facet of our country, it's like we constantly go back and forth, especially when one party runs away with election, like with wins, and thinks that that's a mandate to go even further to the right or to the left.
The question then is, where is the middle ground on immigration, given that we think Trump is going to make immigration such an important part of his first 100 days? He wants to, as I understand it, the incoming administration wants to trigger a kind of left liberal anguish about what they're doing, because they're so confident that they have the majority now on immigration, because America is moving in that direction on immigration. Do you think there would be a backlash over a very, very fierce immigration policy, even if it's just sound and fury rather than actual policy?
I think right now they're beating the drum right now to make it seem like there's some huge, like, mass deportation that's going to happen, like you would see in a movie where, like, people are being rounded up and put in prisons and, you know, they're just mass disruption just to create the impression like something big is coming. We're going to execute on our promise, right? And maybe they will, or they'll attempt to. But if there's one thing I've learned from the Trump administration, they are very sloppy in their execution of policies, and they often have to roll them back, either because the courts challenge them or because they just mess up. Like, remember the Muslim ban on like day one, when they basically stopped air traffic? People were locked up in like various places around the country. It was a mess. And other people always get swept up, and this innocent people get swept up in mass deportations. You're going to see, you know, stories on the news of children being separated from their parents, orphaned. I mean, there's still a ton of children from the first round of child separation that are just completely lost and have not been able to reconcile with their parents. And I think, like, ultimately, there'll be a sense that the administration is not doing it in a humane or responsible way, because they've never really been that great at execution. Now, will there be chaos? Will there be victims of this? Yeah, I do think so. But I think it could backfire too. Because, like, if there was one thing that the American people showed Trump, was that they felt like he didn't do a good job of handling COVID, right? And they didn't vote for him the next time. he's not great at like actual execution. He's great at politicking. He's great at policy, like coming up with catchy policy terms and selling you on policy. That's why he always, when he's hiring someone for a cabinet posting, he's thinking about how you look on TV and how you can sell that policy, right? That's what matters in marketing and branding. But the actual execution of things, has Trump ever been really that good at that?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about that, because that's, you know, something you hear a lot is that he just thinks about it in terms of TV casting. Central casting is one of his favorite phrases.
He's a producer at the end of the day. But he really is.
Yeah. But I mean, other people say, you know, he is putting smart people in behind, or actually there are people who seem to be, you know, media showmen who actually are quite intelligent. But then you get someone like Sebastian Gorka coming in, and you think, oh no, maybe it is all just about sort of TV. He's just seen them on TV, likes their TV appearances.
Doesn't Sebastian Gorka sell like herbal supplements on Fox or something?
Fish oil, yeah, I think.
Yeah. Oh yeah, normal. I'm haunted by one of those ads I saw of him like fishing while selling fish oil. How random. Some guy from Hungary with a British accent ends up in the White House and he calls himself Dr. Sebastian Gorka. I don't even know what he has a doctorate in, but like, we don't do that in America. I know in Europe, a lot of people like to add doctor in front of their name.
Yes.
We don't really do that. I mean, I know Jill Biden did that and she was kind of mocked.
Well, we once got in trouble at Spectator because we did a piece. We said, if Jill Biden can be a doctor, so can Sebastian Gorka. And
right.
He was very angry about that. He didn't like that at all. Didn't find that.
Whatever.
Funny.
I'm not like, I just feel like that's just not our society in a lot of ways. Like we don't, like we are status driven, but maybe
it's too much to actually pretend to be a doctor when you're not. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like being like, I'm Tara Palmieri Esquire because I have a law degree.
Yeah.
Like, it's just not, we don't do that. It's a little weird. But yes, Trump is like, Trump probably just likes the way he sounds and way he looks and how he presents himself. He sounds intelligent, right? At the very least, like, you know, Americans are easily swayed by a British accent. They think you're 20% smarter than you are. yeah. And take that as a compliment. You seem intelligent yourself, though. But this
take 40.
You know, so Trump probably just likes the way he looks. He's on TV all the time. How much influence is he going to have? I mean, as much as he can get away with. I remember when I was reporting on Trump in 2018, you know, H.R. McMaster, the national security advisor, the second one, he managed to convince Trump to sign off on selling Ukraine anti-tank missiles by like slipping him a document and just saying, oh, sign here. Okay. And Trump signed there. And I had gotten this from sources, whatever. And that was a big deal because Obama would never sell anti-tank missiles to Ukraine. And it was definitely a provocation. And Trump was trying to play cozy with Putin and, well, you know, you're selling anti-tank missiles to Ukraine. But that was something that H.R. McMaster was able to do just by way of like not drawing attention to what he was doing and just kind of like, just do this sign here. So if Sebastian Gorka is able to sort of sell an idea to Trump in which he doesn't read it and he signs off on it, sure, he can have some say. Does Sebastian Gorka have a good relationship with Susie Wiles? That matters. But like I said, the Oval Office is a revolving door. She can't close that door, you know? So, he has influence. He could have incredible influence. But you got to play the politics inside the house, too. And the other thing about Sebastian is he's been with him for the past 8 years. I think everyone who's a new person has less influence than someone who's been around for a while. But like, look at Elon Musk, who's been outwardly campaigning for Rick Scott for Senate Majority Leader. He lost that race. Trump wouldn't put his finger on the scale. If Trump said everyone vote for Rick Scott, Rick Scott would be the Senate Majority Leader. He said no, let the Senate deal with it. Elon Musk campaigns for Howard Lutnick for Treasury Secretary. He lost that one. So sometimes Trump likes to put people in their place too and show them who's really boss. But I think if you're savvy enough about it and not as ham-fisted as say someone like Elon Musk, you might be able to win a little bit. But like eventually Trump got really tired of Steve Bannon trying to tell him what to do. And he didn't like the memes that showed Bannon as the boss, pulling him as a puppet and Bannon as the puppet master.
Well, I suppose that comes back to what you were saying at the beginning, which is that in 2016, it was the Republican Party versus the kind of anti-globalist MAGA people. Where now, the Republican Party is kind of finding ways to get what it wants, either through Susie Wiles or through the Senate. It's becoming a bit cannier about the way it deals with Trump. Is that a fair point?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's just grown to understand him. Also, a lot of the dissidents to him are gone. Liz Cheney's gone. Adam Kinzinger's gone. Mitt Romney, I think he's out of the, or did he, is he still there? I can't remember if he ran for re-election. I think he's gone, yeah. So, Jeff Flake, I mean, I could keep going. It's very clear that if you try to resist Trump in any way, he will help a primary challenger take you out, which is really quite an easy thing in America because the people who vote in our primaries are usually like rabid on the left or the right. And Trump owns those people, the grassroots in that sense. So no point in resisting him. The only way to do it is to work around him, essentially. Try to talk to him, get through his allies. I don't know. Present him with the worst case scenario. Try to get the adult in the room, whoever that is. It's going to be interesting because I think like look at Mitch McConnell. I mean, he completely capitulated to Trump.
Yes. Well, he had to. And there was that biography of him that came out this year, McKay Coppins, I think it is.
Yeah.
And Romney really, really hates Trump and sees his mission in life
they
is
all
to try
do.
And stop him.
Yeah. They all, a lot of them hate Trump. Mm. Like on a visceral level.
Because privately. He destroyed what was their party in their eyes.
Yeah. And he's not of their ilk. These are gentlemen. You go into the Senate, it's a gentleman's club. You know, they don't act like Trump is like a rowdy House member. He's like a member of the House Freedom Caucus. Those people embarrass Senate leaders that they even have to like share a bathroom, although I'm not sure they even have to because the chambers are so separate. But still, like there's a feeling that Trump is not like them and they're statesmen. He doesn't act like a statesman. A lot of these senators believe they should be president, you know?
You talking about gentlemen has made me think of Matt Gaetz, weirdly.
He's in the Congress. He was in Congress. He's a House, you know, House
But
member.
He'll be back in Congress now.
Is that what he announced? He's going back in?
Well, that's not the theory, isn't it? Your theory in your piece is that he might be governor of Florida.
Oh, yeah. Well, he does really well. You know, he does really well in the polls in Florida. He's very popular there. Florida's a weird place, though. I mean, we used to say this when I worked at the New York Post. Like, you could get away with murder in Florida. The juries are weird. Casey Anthony, case in point. I mean, like, there's so many. Like, Florida's just a weird place. They are so MAGA. He's so close to Trump. He speaks their language. Kevin McCarthy used his leftover funds, millions of dollars, to try to take out Matt Gaetz in a primary in Florida. And you would think a guy who's on investigation for sex trafficking and minor would, he denies that obviously, but would be very vulnerable to a primary. No, Matt like shut it down by more than 20 points. So, and in all the polling, Matt Gaetz is very high up there among potential candidates for governor, including Casey DeSantis, who's maybe a little bit more popular than him. Matt Gaetz is up there, Byron Donalds. I don't think Matt's political career in Florida is over at all. Now, do I think he's going back into Congress? I'm not sure. I think ultimately at the end of the day, he really likes being on television. And I think he would be happy to have a TV job. I just don't think those doors are open for him anymore ever since those allegations and the investigation came out, especially in Fox. But he's on Newsmax all the time. So maybe he gets his own show on Newsmax. Or OANN or one of these other shows, One America News Network. He could do that. But I think ultimately he would probably use it as a platform to go back into politics in Florida.
Well, we shall see and watch with interest. Tara, it's been fascinating to have your insights. Please do come on again. Dr. Para Talmeri, I should say.
Yeah, no, I don't have that.
Great to have you on.
I didn't go through that sort of educational rigor, and I admire people that do, but kind of mock people who use it as a status thing at the same time.
Quite agree. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for listening to that episode of The Americano Show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave rave reviews on whatever platform you listen to it on. I would like to thank, of course, my brilliant producer, Natasha Farrows. Thanks again for listening. All the best.